The following program from the North Carolina Reading Service is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm John Fetterson, welcoming you to another edition of Indie Week. And today's program, this week's program, is dated May the 18th of 2023. And we'll get right down to business. Our first article by Lena Geller from Durham reports on a generic issue featuring publications of news all over this country, and specifically the Triangle area, which involves this publication, Indie Week. She writes, "After a turbulent two decades marked by ownership changes, newsroom cuts, and circulation slashes, the Herald Sun, Durham's only daily newspaper, has become a ghost newspaper, a publication that bears its original name but no longer creates its own content. Instead, publishing stories sourced from larger newspapers in its parent media conglomerate. When local newspapers, particularly dailies, are shuttered or stripped of staff, routine political coverage and insightful commentary fall by the wayside. Power goes unchecked, and community voices go unheard. The handful of full-time reporters who currently cover Durham for the News and Observer and TV stations like WRAL do good work, but Durham is a big city for just a few people to cover. Here to help bridge the gap are a number of citizen and community journalism initiatives working to keep area residents informed while traditional reportage wanes and changes. Full disclosure, in parentheses, all the subjects interviewed have shared pieces from the Indie, including recent work by this reporter, i.e. Lena Geller. For some, the initiatives also aim to amplify voices and experiences that have long been underrepresented in traditional newspapers. In January, Brian Calloway launched one of the newest initiatives, a Substack email letter called Bull City Public Investigators, BCPI. Calloway, a former Durham City Council candidate with a background in city planning, spent 4 years working as the coordinator of energy and sustainability for Durham Public Schools before shifting to a career in sales. Calloway says a desire to add context and source material to a public comment he'd given at a school board meeting sparked the idea for the Substack. The board had voted unanimously to spend $8 million on outsourced project management services, which school system employees usually handle, as its first expenditure of a $423.5 million general obligation bond that Durham voters passed in November. The allotted 3-minute comment period, Calloway says, had not provided him with enough time to shed light on the nuances around the board's decision and the chosen firm. His 1,000-word post on BCPI Substack remains, as far as the Indie can tell, the only coverage of that vote. A week later, when Calloway got wind that former school board member Matt Sears had resigned his seat and taken a position at the privately run DPS Foundation, he wrote about that, too. This time, he tried to get formal news outlets to take the reins. He says, "I was tweeting at all the local journalists that I knew in hopes they would cover it. I didn't want to cover it. I'm not a journalist." When no one responded, he followed up with a more comprehensive BCPI piece on that resignation, which garnered thousands of views. A month and a half passed before any mainstream publications got around to covering it. Not too long ago, Calloway says, the Herald Sun had a reporter, Greg Childress, who now works at North Carolina Newsline, at every school board meeting. In 2018, when custodians, whose services had long been outsourced to a contracting company, were vying to be hired as DPS employees in order to receive benefits. Childress wrote a series of stories that caused, quote, a sea change among electeds, Calloway recalls, in how they thought about the employment status of contract workers. The board shifted custodians to DPS employees soon after those reports published. When Childress was laid off later that year, Calloway says there was a distinct void of coverage. BCPI then became an attempt to fill that void. The Substack's coverage primarily centers around topics in Calloway's wheelhouse, that is to say, DPS, and land use. Calloway is not trying to be a substitute for news, he says, and views BCPI as more of a response than a long-term solution to Durham's dearth of local reporting. For now, though, when he sees issues going uncovered, he says he feels obligated to do his part in publicizing them. He says, I cannot tell you how many times I've had people ask me, why is there not a story about this? Where can I read about this? Next, Justin Laidlaw, a Durham native who provides local multimedia coverage on the platform he created called Buddy Rusky, recently broadened his reportage in response to a similar sentiment from a community member. In July of 2022, Laidlaw noticed a Twitter user post about a perceived gap in Indy Week's coverage, that is, routine articles on Durham City Council meetings. Laidlaw said, I was like, I could try that. I don't have any particular expertise, but I could give it a shot. Up until that point, Buddy Rusky's content, which includes newsletters, blogs, and podcasts, had mostly revolved around Bull City culture and infrastructure. In September 2021, for instance, he published a blog post about Durham outdoor dining initiative, The Streetery, examining the ways in which the COVID pandemic had caused the city to rethink long-standing systems tied to non-essential vehicle traffic. Laidlaw, who studied journalism at North Carolina Central and spent 6 years covering arts and culture for the now-defunct Durham Media website Clarion Content, launched Buddy Rusky in 2020 with the initial aim of building his portfolio. He says, I didn't have a ton of things on my resume to compete with folks coming out of journalism school who interned at places like NPR or PBS. It was one of those situations where you don't have the experience, so you can't get the jobs, but you can't get the jobs, so you can't get the experience. I started to think, okay, well, I'm going to have to build this experience on my own. Since then, Buddy Rusky has evolved into a project that works to serve the community by both platforming untold stories and making complex topics easy to understand. After seeing that Twitter user's plea for more routine city council coverage, he launched a newsletter called By the Horns that provides comprehensive reports on nearly every city council meeting. The newsletters, which Laidlaw pens after attending meetings in person, typically include a bulleted summary, a deep dive on one or two notable topics, and a Civics 101 section to help readers understand terms and processes involved in city government. Laidlaw is learning alongside his readers, which results in reports that are more accessible to the average person. At the most recent city council meeting, for instance, speakers were throwing around the phrase Council of State, which Laidlaw had never heard before. He noted it as something to define in his newsletter. Quote, I could imagine somebody watching the meeting and just freezing when they heard that or having it go right over their head. Laidlaw doesn't know what exactly Buddy Rusky will look like in the long term, but he envisions collaborations with other area journalists. Their skills give him hope for a solid future for the Fourth Estate, he says. Just knowing that the talent is here makes me think eventually things will tilt in the right direction and we'll be able to rebuild journalistic institutions in a new 21st century way. When Paxton Media Group acquired the Herald Sun in 2004, it laid off 80 of the paper's 350 staffers. Some who survived the acquisition were asked to take pay cuts the following year, including Reverend Carl Kenney, a columnist who quit in response to the proposed reduction, and who has mixed feelings about the role he served during his 8 years at the paper. The Herald Sun, he says, had given him the opportunity to do something that no one else was doing, write about the black community from the perspective of a black reporter. When Kenny says he appreciated the program, he also felt pigeonholed by the paper's leadership, who all but required him to discuss race in his columns, as he had footholds in a community that white reporters didn't. Other columnists had more flexibility. And he says, in many ways, what I was being asked to do was be the gatekeeper for black community stories. Kenny currently works as an adjunct professor at the Hussman School of Journalism, UNC Chapel Hill. Quote, I was having to write these stories about black life and open it up for the white world to see. Here we are, see the black people, see the black people. When, he says, the devil came and purchased the newspaper, he wanted to create a way to continue the work he'd been doing at the Herald Sun, but with a broader lens. In 2007, Kenny, who also has a Master's of Divinity degree and previously served as the pastor of church congregations in Durham and Missouri, launched Rev Elution, a blog with the stated mission, quote, engaging readers into a meaningful discussion related to matters that impact faith and society. During the first years of Rev Elution, Kenny wrote about Durham happenings, but also engaged in national conversations around race, religion, sexuality, and gender, reflecting on things like Fox News host Megyn Kelly's insistence that Jesus and Santa Claus are white. But in 2016, when Kenny returned to Durham after a three-year stint as an adjunct professor at the University of Missouri, he felt a need to shift his blog writing. During his time in Missouri, he'd been writing in the heat of the death of Michael Brown, he says, which changed some of his theory of reporting. Quote, I was incensed by what I saw coming from the Indy. I was incensed by what I saw coming from what remained of the merging of the Herald Sun and the News and Observer. It was really whitewashed. It was reporting that was coming from a very biased lens. After that, Rev Elution became more centered around the black community in Durham. The blog's recent posts, for instance, include coverage and commentary on Kevin Primus's run for school board, a Q&A with Walter Jackson shortly before he was elected as chair of the Durham Committee on the Affairs of Black People, and a brief background on Soul City, ahead of a related discussion at the Durham History Museum. Soon, though, Rev Elution may go on hiatus. In June, Kenny is shifting gears to helm the reboot of the Durham Voice, a community newspaper that covered northeast central Durham before pausing circulation shortly after the onset of the pandemic. The Durham Voice was founded in 2009 with the aim of helping reduce crime after the murder of UNC Chapel Hill student body president Eve Carson by, quote, encouraging a vital civic life and developing a positive sense of place among young people in the region of coverage, per the paper's website. Student journalists from local colleges will continue to write for the Durham Voice, Kenny says, though the revamped version of the paper will expand its coverage across Durham and incorporate multimedia coverage. While traditional reporters are required to abide by ethics codes and impartiality standards, citizen journalism initiatives like BCPI and Buddy Ruskie are not. which raises some questions. If their content is intended to function as local news, should they adhere to the same principles with which conventional publications comply? Should Calloway and Laidlaw say, avoid doing advocacy work around an issue their coverage presents through a seemingly objective lens? Calloway, who until now has published BCPI anonymously, says he strives for impartiality and supports the information in his articles with hyperlinked citations. But as an, quote, engaged public citizen who sometimes petitions for policy changes, he's still figuring out where the line is, he says. Laidlaw describes his approach as still evolving, but rooted in transparency. In a March edition of By the Horns, for instance, he included a disclaimer acknowledging his role as a volunteer board member with Bike Durham, as representatives from the organization spoke during the budget meeting referenced in that newsletter. For Kenny, whose blog takes a form closer to an opinion column than a news report, impartiality is less of a concern, though he notes that the principle has historically been wielded in a way that squelches key perspectives. Kenny says, the lines that have been created around impartiality are sort of used to dismiss the role of the black press as an agent for reform. It is a detention that we face as black reporters, that we enter into the spaces where there's a requirement that we shed ourselves of who we are for the sake of being an unbiased voice for people. Kenny views the rise of citizen and community journalism initiatives as a sign that local media is heading in a good direction, one that more closely aligns with the way journalism was originally intended to function. Quote, the reason we have a constitution that protects the press is this idea from John Stuart Mill that we flood the marketplace with ideas, and democracy gives people the chance to decide which one of these absurd ideas is the one they want to lean on. One person working to aggregate Durham's marketplace of ideas is Kenneth Webb, who in 2019 founded what could be seen as another citizen journalism initiative in Durham, a Facebook page called Bull City Political Nerd. Webb, a web development contractor, says he created the page to channel his personal interest in politics into something that could help keep community members informed. He generates and shares an enormous amount of local news content each week, typically posting links to articles with a few sentences of summary and occasionally writing his own blurbs on items that have not received coverage. The page, which has nearly 2,000 followers, raises awareness and fosters productive discussion around important local issues, says Webb. While social media and the Internet as a whole have wreaked havoc on the business models of traditional local publications, Kenny says there's a benefit to technology forcing a way of rethinking our media institutions. Quote, I don't feed into the idea that local journalism is a dying thing. I think it's actually adapting to the change. Next, we move to Raleigh and a column by Jasmine Gallup called Rent Wrangling. Sebastian Fernandez Giraldo, like many tenants in the Triangle, has seen his rent go up by hundreds of dollars in the last few years. Quote, we're all seeing double-digit rent increases. He's a community advocate with the Triangle Tenants Union. I've already seen my rent go up like 10%. As Indy previously reported, these rent increases have forced many to leave the Triangle, relocating to cheaper suburban or rural neighborhoods. If you have a car and a steady job, being forced to relocate outside of downtown Raleigh or Durham may not be such a big deal. But for people who are older or working a minimum wage job, rent hikes could leave them unemployed or unable to access critical resources like health care. Charles Becker, a professor of economics at Duke University, says in East Durham you have massive gentrification. If you're an owner-occupier, then okay, you make capital gain, but about half the housing in Durham County is rental. And the people who are most vulnerable are elderly and poor, and they are being displaced. As the Triangle undergoes an economic boom, landlords are rapidly raising rents to meet market rates. According to a 2023 report by the nonprofit NC Housing Coalition, about 45% of renters in Wake County have difficulty affording their homes, compared to only about 16% of homeowners. Becker says the area's rapid economic growth means there are winners and losers. So there are hugely unfortunate consequences to this, and we've only been seeing it fairly recently. With all the pressure renters are under, some elected officials are considering what they can do to help. Last month, three newly elected Raleigh City Council members resurrected a controversial policy idea, rent control. Back in April, Raleigh City Council newcomers Jane Harrison, Megan Patton, and Christina Jones threw their support behind a state bill, Senate 225, that proposed giving cities and towns like Raleigh the power to regulate rents. The bill, introduced by Senator Lisa Grafstein, Democrat of Wake, was likely doomed from the start in the Republican-dominated legislature and died in committee, as expected. Harrison, Patton, and Jones, however, each say they want to continue conversations about policies like rent control and inclusionary zoning that are currently banned under state law. Harrison says, in Raleigh, the median rent is now about $2,000, with prices having grown 20% year over year. So I think about, is that an affordable rent for a daycare worker? What about a 911 operator? We have essential workers who are struggling to stay in our city. Harrison admits rent control is not a perfect solution, but she believes it's one major element that could help the city create housing affordability. When it comes to housing, subsidy, supply, and stability are essential, says the councilwoman. Quote, stability for me is about regulating the housing market to eliminate price gouging and ensure affordable housing is built as part of all developments. And rent control is just one tool to bring about more stability in the marketplace. When it comes to rent control, Harrison favors short-term stabilization measures over decades-long rent caps like those found in New York City. For example, a rule that rents can only be raised by a certain percentage each year could soften the blow of rapid economic growth for renters and give them time to figure out where to live. Patton agrees, saying such a rule would provide a measure of predictability for renters. Quote, while it wouldn't lock their rents in at the same price, it would create some guardrails around when their rents could be raised and by how much, so that people could plan to stay in their spaces. For Harrison, rent control is a governmental tool that may be appropriate to use as economic forces shift and the housing market changes. There's no permanent rent cap that will fix the housing crisis, she says. Today, with interest rates high, Harrison expects to see rent hikes slow down. So she says perhaps rent control won't be necessary in the near term, but what if Raleigh had had this tool at its disposal a few years ago? How many more residents could have remained in their homes, stayed near their kids' school districts, or near their jobs? For renters in Raleigh, many of whom are struggling to pay their monthly bills, putting a cap on what landlords can charge sounds pretty good. But many economists agree that while rent control can have short-term benefits, there are long-standing consequences. Rent caps can incentivize landlords to sell their property, reducing the overall availability of rental housing, according to the Brookings Institution. Rent control can also disincentivize developers from building new rental housing, researchers contend. Becker says it deters people from building structures if they think they're not going to be able to charge market price. In Durham, he expects rent control would prompt a shift in construction from rental housing to owner-occupied housing. And he says it's not like you're redistributing from wealthy young professionals to the elderly poor. There will be some of that initially, but in the long run, there's not going to be a whole lot of it. One study of rent control in San Francisco found that landlords were 8% more likely to convert rent-controlled apartments, as opposed to non-controlled apartments, into condos that they could sell at market price. The study also found that a 1994 expansion of rent control in that city led to a 15% decline in non-rent-controlled apartments and a 25% decline in rent-controlled apartments, according to the Brookings Institution. The overall decline in the supply of rental housing in San Francisco raised the cost of all housing in the long run, contributing to gentrification, that report concludes. As far as the triangle is concerned, Becker says, I don't think rent control is an answer. It mucks up the market, he adds. New York City has had serious rent control for ages, and in the long run, the winners and losers tend to be almost randomly distributed. You have some people who are low income who benefit enormously. They pass it on to their children. Other people who are not fortunate end up paying more for comparable housing elsewhere. Asked about the potential consequences of rent control, Harrison says, we definitely need to be careful. If a municipality were to set a cap on rent increases, that cap cannot be so blunt or so extreme that it then curtails a healthy marketplace for rental units. We don't want our landlords to say, I don't want to be in this business any longer. There has to be a focus on preventing price gouging more than anything, not to overregulate the housing market. In addressing the affordable housing crisis, Becker suggests a more targeted solution, like a county fund to subsidize the rents of the most vulnerable rentals, elderly and poor. Subsidy or financial support for low-income residents is also a piece of Harrison's strategy to create affordable housing. The only problem is that, once again, the state legislature has made it difficult for local cities and towns to enact such policies. According to Becker, a development impact tax, a tax on new construction that's designed to finance the need for additional public services, could help finance such a fund. But, like rent control and inclusionary zoning, the tool is currently prohibited under state law. Throughout the triangle, people disagree on rent control, but one thing some do agree on is that local governments should have the power to enact policies that could help address the housing crisis. Patton says, as a city, we are often limited and preempted by state government on using tools that might be appropriate for our city. Rent control is one of those. Patton does not unconditionally support rent control, she says, but she would have liked to see the bill get out of the committee so the city council could at least discuss it. Jones likewise says she wants to raise these issues despite lawmakers' opposition, saying, I understand the legislature is not going to want a specific bill. They're not going to let this one go through the Rules Committee, or they may not let the next one go through. But if we continue to pursue it and show that this is what we're about, this is what we stand for, then hopefully we can gain some traction. If we don't try something, then we don't have anything, Jones adds. Others have reservations about lobbying the legislature like this, however. Eric Brown, a former land use attorney and chair of the Raleigh Planning Commission, says with rent control unlikely to receive support from the Republican-dominated state legislature, supporting it is, quote, performative politics. It distracts from the efforts of those working on improving housing affordability using the tools available today, Brown wrote in an email. Moreover, supporting rent control could alienate lawmakers, Brown argues. Writing, because Raleigh is the state capital, legislators closely follow what the city and its leaders are doing. Posting support for a bill that is viewed as extreme by Republicans and that has no chance of passing could come back to haunt the city when it asks the General Assembly to pass its broader legislative agenda. For Fernandez Hiraldo, the Raleigh renter, state legislation supporting rent control is essentially a pipe dream. For renters, solutions are going to come from the ground up, he says. Protections like rent control and maintenance regulations will only come if renters organize and put pressure on landlords. Quote, if people want to take control over their rent, they need to organize with their neighbors, take collective action, and take back control. We can't really rely on legislators, landlords, and capitalists to do that for us. The legislature is run by landlords, whether they have an R or a D next to their name. Now from Tomasi McDonald, again in Durham, corruption complaint. Attorneys for retired Durham Superior Court Judge Jim Harden and a Guilford County couple confirmed this week that both parties agreed to dismiss complaints they had filed in the Bull City's Superior Court. For the Greensboro couple, Joseph Wooten and Erica Bishop, Harden's decision to drop his lawsuit means they are no longer on the hook for nearly $250,000 to the legal titan who evicted them from the basement of a building he owns and manages on 9th Street. Wooten said about the sum of money Harden demanded, we couldn't move. Wooten and Bishop invested tens of thousands of dollars to transform the basement of the historic Couch Building on 9th Street into the Bull City Selfie Museum, a photo studio that featured more than 20 photo booths before Harden evicted them in February of last year. Last week, Wooten and Bishop signed an agreement with Harden that dismissed their owing overdue rent and liquidated damages in the total amount of $238,000. Wooten told Indy, we are extremely satisfied with the outcome of the case. Now, the agreement signed by Harden and the Guilford County couple was not yet publicly available last Monday. A clerk in the downtown Durham Superior Court's Civil Division said the agreement has not yet been fully processed in the court's electronic system. Harden's attorney, J. Gray Wilson of Durham, told Indy that both parties agreed to drop their claims against each other. It was on September 8, 2021, that Wooten and Bishop signed a lease and spent close to $250,000 to open the Bull City Selfie Museum in the Couch Building basement. As Indy previously reported, Wooten and Bishop say that Harden forcibly ejected them on February 8th for non-payment of rent. Wooten and Bishop filed a countersuit in April contesting Harden's claim and stated they were unable to open the business because of the construction company's failure to obtain a building permit from the City of Durham's Inspections Department. Then Harden rented the place by early fall to tenants who used the couple's designs and business plans to open the red carpet selfie studio. City inspection records show the basement still does not have a building permit that would allow it to open for business. Wooten and Bishop are satisfied with their agreement with Harden, but now they want justice. They're moving forward with litigation against a contractor and his associate who did construction work on the space, Bishop told the Indy. Last year, Michael Moore, the owner of that construction company that transformed the basement of that building into a selfie studio, filed a complaint, seeking nearly $40,000 in damages from the couple. On March 23rd, Wooten and Bishop's attorney, Garrett Davis of Durham, filed a 62-page complaint in Superior Court that claims Moore and an associate, Stephen Baumgartner, violated federal racketeering laws. They say Moore's construction company and related enterprises are corrupt and have been for years. Durham attorney David Lewis, who has represented Moore in the past, told the Indy he expects to represent Moore again in the civil case, saying he hasn't been served yet and will make an appropriate comment when the time comes. The Guilford County couple's lawsuit names Moore and his businesses, Moore's Commercial and Residential Development, LLC, and Moore's Construction Company, LLC, formerly known as Baumgartner Investments, LLC Construction, along with Baumgartner. Wooten and Bishop claim that Moore and Baumgartner violated the Federal Racketeer-Influenced and Corrupt Organizations, RICO, Act of 1970, that's primarily used to target organized crime. In addition to violating the RICO Act, Wooten and Bishop claim that Moore and Baumgartner engaged in unfair and deceptive trade practices through, quote, a pattern and practice of submitting false certification to state licensing authorities for the purpose of maintaining general contractor licenses. Baumgartner this week told the Indy that questions from this writer marked the first time he had even heard about the complaint, that writer again being Tomasi McDonald. Davis states in the court affidavit that he discovered the alleged corruption after Hardin evicted Wooten and Bishop. The couple lost the $140,000 they had paid Moore to build out the Bull City Selfie Museum, BCSM. Davis says no one from Moore's Construction ever submitted a building permit to the city of Durham before BCSM was evicted in February 8th of 2022. At the crux of Wooten and Bishop's contention is that Moore and Baumgartner were operating a corrupt enterprise. Under North Carolina's general statutes, the recipient of a general contractor's license must be a responsible managing member or an employee of the business, according to the lawsuit. Davis states, quote, Moore has never passed the general contractor's exam, nor has he personally gone through all of the other application steps a licensed contractor must go through. Davis contends that Moore and Baumgartner, quote, reached an agreement. Baumgartner would take the general contractor license exam, obtain the license, and eventually become a qualifier and responsible managing member for his construction business. And less than 12 weeks after being granted a general contractor's license on February 25, 2014, Baumgartner Investments, LLC, became known as Moore's Construction, LLC. Davis states in the complaint, then Baumgartner moved to Texas. The complaint states Baumgartner has been a permanent resident and registered voter in the state of Texas since November of 2014. Wooten and Bishop's lawsuit includes Baumgartner's voter registration record, which states he lives in Pearland, Texas. He ran for a seat on the Brazoria County, Texas School Board, according to a candidate's application he filed for a May 6th election. He wrote that he's lived in Texas for 7 years and 8 months. Baumgartner told the Indy that although he has a permanent address in Texas, he spends, quote, more than half my time here in North Carolina and has for many years. I was born and raised here. He ran for the school board as an absentee candidate and lost terribly. I'm never there, he explained. It's very hard to win a race when you're never there. My wife lives there, but my businesses have required me to be more here than there. Davis states in the complaint that Baumgartner, quote, annually submits false certification to the state's General Contractors Board to maintain Moore's Construction LLC's license. Davis says, by law, a responsible managing member or employee means a person who is engaged in the work of the applicant a minimum of 20 hours per week or a majority of the hours operated by the applicant, whichever is less. He later added that it's doubtful Baumgartner could have met that requirement while living thousands of miles away in Texas. Bishop says, we never met Baumgartner. Joseph and I were on site every day for the upfit of our business, and Baumgartner was not there. Davis, in the complaint, says Moore and Baumgartner concocted a sham qualifier scheme that enables Baumgartner to receive kickbacks from companies that find it cheaper to do business with him instead of hiring an on-site general contractor to monitor their work. Davis states the economics behind this arrangement is simple. Upon information and belief, Baumgartner is provided a kickback-like payment by Moore, as well as the owners of the firm, like Promark Construction in Durham, Trinity Consulting and Development in Guilford County. Each year, Mr. Baumgartner allows those companies to use his name and number to maintain a general contractor's license. He later adds that someone was, quote, illegally selling their name and credentials to not one, not two, at least three corporations for the express purpose of allowing these corporations to maintain occupational license is a quintessential racket. As the Indy previously reported, Frank Weisner, executive director of the North Carolina Licensing Board for General Contractors, confirmed in March that Moore's Construction is under investigation for potential violations of the state statutes concerning general contractors. Curtis Huff, an investigator with the State Licensing Board, told Indy that the agency still has an active investigation going on. Davis added that under state law, any construction work over $30,000 requires a general contracting license. And Davis said in a phone call to Indy, for jobs under $30,000, with hard work, a little bit of elbow grease, a truck, and a cell phone, you can be a handyman. Which is all Michael Moore has, a truck and a cell phone, and he's taking on jobs for hundreds of thousands of dollars. All right, here is a food and drink article. We don't get to very many of these in our time available, but Gabby Mendick, food at IndyWeek.com, has written Market Meals, specifically targeting, well, I'll just read the article. How about that? Joe Luo, the owner of Love Bao Taiwanese Kitchen, is a food vendor tucked inside Carrie's H Mart. And he says, Love Bao has been able to allow people to try and eat classic Taiwanese dishes in a town that still doesn't have as many Asian options as other big cities. It also allows people from Taiwan to have a taste of home when they're far, far away. H Mart, like a handful of other international grocery stores scattered across the triangle, serve as vital resources for immigrant communities, providing hard-to-source ingredients, access to favorite snacks, and produce that does not grow in North Carolina. And the author specifies Li Ming's Global Market and Compare Foods in Durham, Almedina Market, K-Town Market, and El Toro in Raleigh. Among this rich scene, the unsung heroes of international grocery stores are the food purveyors like Luo, who operate businesses inside these stores. You're not likely to stumble across these vendors on Yelp, local food blogs, or best of lists. While some do business with their own unique branding, others don't have names independent of the larger store in which they operate. Many vendors are owned and operated by the grocery store itself, while others rent out the space and operate independently. These unostentatious outposts are perfect for grabbing a quick bite after a long shopping trip, but beyond their convenience, They've also become culinary destinations in their own right, with mouth-watering plates of affordable dishes from around the world. First, the Filipino Express at the Oriental Store on Capitol Boulevard, Raleigh. Tucked inside Filipino Grocery, the Oriental Store of Raleigh, the Filipino Express offers savory staples like lumpia and adobo, as well as sweets like cassava cake and halo-halo. Owner Mark Libago explains that when his wife's aunt, Maria Victoria Nyangchua, opened the store in 1970, it was the first international grocery store of any kind in the region. At the time, Oriental Store carried a range of international products catering to many immigrant populations. But as different communities grew and more international stores opened, Oriental Store shifted to specializing in Filipino items. In those early days, staff at Oriental Store would often request that Chua cook lunch for them during their shifts. Libago says, one day the health inspector came in and my aunt was given a ticket because we were serving food without a license. So then she decided, why not make it a business? 15 years later, the business is still humming. Libago explains, Filipino food is not easy to make, and preparing it properly requires a plethora of herbs and spices. The restaurant, where an array of perfectly balanced stews are served, is particularly appreciated by the Filipino locals, for whom it's difficult to find enough time to cook these complex dishes themselves. Filipino is just one of a few restaurants that found a silver lining in pandemic restrictions. Because the establishment is situated in a grocery store, it was able to remain open and accessible to patrons venturing out for groceries. The customer base grew. Libago, conscious of the need to continually expand that customer base and tactical about growing the business, always wants to welcome new diners from all backgrounds. And he says, in my mind, to grow the business, you have to appeal to the Americans. You have to make sure they love it, because they're the most populous group. If you are only considering the Filipinos, it's limited. Right now, I can see the growth of American customers. He says, Americans tend to be less adventurous when they dine there, typically ordering dishes like lumpia, fried Filipino spring rolls, pancit, a stir-fried noodle, and chicken adobo, a stew that includes a variety of spices, vinegar, and soy sauce, dishes that share elements of cuisines with which American customers are more familiar. While these are the dishes that are most common in the United States, Libago encourages all diners to branch out and taste other dishes. He says, of the dark garlicky pork stew, Filipinos like the dinunguan more. We have this dish that is flavored with pork blood, so it's a very unique taste, but it's very good. Now, over at H Mart on High House Road in Cary, we have Love Bao, Taiwanese kitchen. H Mart is by far the most robust of local international supermarkets in terms of both square footage and the number of independent food vendors who operate there. The Korean supermarket chain was founded in Queens, New York in 1982, and it today has nearly 100 locations across the United States. The supermarket chain is also the subject of musician Michelle Zonder's 2021 memoir, Crying in H Mart. Since the Cary location's opening in 2016, the store has been home to a slew of vendors. The prepared food outlets in H Mart represent a variety of Asian cuisines, serving traditional fare and street foods from across the continent. One of those outputs is Luau's Love Bao, Taiwanese kitchen. In 2015, after living in the United States for 30 years, Luau had moved back to his hometown of Keelung, Taiwan, to train alongside and learn recipes from his father-in-law. There, he opened his own restaurant in the Keelung Night Market. That was a success over the course of his 18 months in business, so he moved his venture back into the United States and in 2019 opened Love Bao Taiwanese Kitchen. The menu features extensive variations on its namesake dish, guabao, a steamed bun. The menu describes as a Taiwanese burger. The original guabao is filled with braised pork belly, pickled mustard greens, powdered peanuts, brown sugar, and cilantro, creating a rich balance of acidic, nutty, sweet, and bright flavors. The menu also features fusion bao recipes, among them the chicken filet guabao, filled with fried chicken, lettuce, tomato, cucumber, honey mustard, and ketchup. The business agreement with H Mart requires that vendors pay rent based on sales, in a sense, a commission. Luau says, we have a working contract with H Mart where we are not responsible for paying many of the expenses of a standalone restaurant, explaining the benefits of the arrangement. And the last feature is La Superior. They're based on North Roxborough Street in Durham. The Hispanic supermarket La Superior is known equally for its robust selection of groceries as it is for its in-store panaderia and pastelería. Its tortilleria that churns out fresh homemade tortillas and its taqueria located inside the store. Whew. La Superior first opened down the street in 1999 in what is now Super Taqueria. That store is owned by three siblings and their spouses, all originally from Mexico City. At the time, Mexican food and ingredients were not readily available in the area. Parentheses, Compare Foods, now a widespread Hispanic grocery chain, didn't arrive in North Carolina until 2004. And the business quickly struck a chord with the local community. La Superior offered, quote, traditional things like chorizo, chicharron, and carnitas that weren't found in other places. They were like, hey, this reminds me of back home, said Yasmin Flores, a daughter and niece of the store owners and a manager at La Superior. Flores' family operated taquerias in Mexico City before immigrating to the United States, and many of the same dishes they serve there are now offered at the taqueria. Through many dishes, from tacos to tortas, are available for purchase across the triangle today. Flores explains that certain cuts of meat that fill these tortillas and sandwiches are more difficult to find locally. Flores says, cabeza, head, tripa, the intestines. There's carnitas that come with bouche, pork stomach. There's lengua, tongue. Listing some of La Superior's more singular menu options. The bakery and tortilleria were new adventures for La Superior. Committed to getting it right, the market hired individuals who had previous expertise baking and making tortillas on a mass scale in Mexico to come hone its shop's recipes and processes. Since then, some of those individuals have gone on to open their own successful businesses. Each morning, trays of conchas and tres leches are taken out of the oven to wait for customers. A wide variety of baked goods are stocked for shoppers to peruse and fill their own trays with colorful breads, cookies, and pastries. At 24, Flores says that she and her cousins feel some generational tension when it comes to running the store. She says, our generation now, we want to be a little bit more Americanized, and our family is still more on the traditional Mexican side, so we butt heads. Times are different. People are advancing. There are so many new options. And slowly we're getting there to do those changes. Still, when it comes to both adapting and preserving tradition, Flores is proud to be working in the family business in which she was raised. And she says, growing up here, this is all I've ever known. I don't want to be closed-minded and say I don't want to learn something else because I actually wanted to go to nursing school. But then I would come here, and I'm like, this is home. And as a sidebar to that article, our list of some other grocery stores that have food vendors in the Triangle area. on Raleigh and Buck Jones Road is the Grand Asia Market, and this is a huge place. It boasts a Chinese restaurant and bakery inside Grand Asia Market. And in Durham, Super Compare is on Avondale Drive, A, Durham, and it offers prepared Caribbean food. K-Town has in Durali Road in Raleigh, Choi's Kitchen serves traditional Korean food. On Westgate Drive in Durham, Lee Ming's, 3400 Westgate, prepared hearty Chinese dishes at affordable prices. On Method Road in Raleigh, the Al-Madina Market, delicious halal South Asian takeout. And finally, in Morrisville, on Chapel Hill Road, Bombay Central sells Indian sweets, street foods, and more. Well, with only 2 minutes remaining for me, I have only time to mention these articles, which can be found on the free print edition of Indie Independent or on IndieWeek.com. And the first is about Hari Kondabolu. Kondabolu is a humorist, and he is going to Motorco Music Hall on Thursday tonight, May 18. He's a comedian known for material that tackles big issues like race, colonialism, and immigration. And so that is Motorco Music Hall tonight at 8 p.m., admission $25. Then we have Jamaica Holloway, the director, who is busy working on a two-person show, Single Black Female. That's appearing at, at the Mettlesome, Bulldog Ensemble Theater in Mettlesome. Again, tonight through Sunday, May the 28th. And finally, a music article, Tacoma Park, a recording by Benjamin Felton and John Harrison. Take a Walk in the Woods with Dreaming Machines on their second record at Tacoma Park. Well, here comes our music. Thanks, everyone, for checking out this week's issue of Indie Week. And it's available as a podcast. Our initial broadcast of this will be Friday. And we will be back, John Federson, back, I believe, next week. I'm still on duty for Indie Week. Thanks, everyone, to listening to the North Carolina Reading Service. Bye-bye.